You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's In-Depth Series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project. It's a pleasure to have you with us today on Tuesday, April 25th. It's also a great pleasure and an honor to be joined today virtually in our studio by Senator Peter Welch. Mr. Welch, thank you very much for making the time for this conversation, and I should say welcome back to GNAT and the News Project.
Well, thank you. It's really great to be back.
As many of you know, since Senator Welch is one of those people who doesn't really need an introduction, he first became involved in Vermont politics over four decades ago in 1980. He ran for the Vermont Senate for Windsor County. Served there until 1989. He was the first Democrat who became the president pro tem of the Vermont Senate. And then fast forwarding to 2006, he ran for U.S. Congress, replacing Bernie Sanders, who was moving on to the U.S. Senate at that point. And he was there in Congress representing Vermont until last year, when, of course, he ran for the Senate. We are very pleased and grateful and honored to have you with us today, Senator Welch. So many things to talk about on a very busy news day, news week, but one thing I'd like to start with is the whole question around the debt ceiling situation that the U.S. government is facing. The government can borrow up to a certain amount of money to pay for items in the budget, and in the past, at least, Congress has raised that debt ceiling when that became necessary. But it seems like there's a bit of a standoff developing in Congress at the moment around that question. I believe the crunch time comes sometime in late May or June, I guess, when the government will simply run out of borrowing capability. So I wondered if you could help us understand what's at stake here. What happens if the U.S. doesn't raise its borrowing limit? Do we go into default, or what's the story?
It would be like you not paying your mortgage, and that doesn't end well. Let me explain the debt ceiling, because it's really almost unique to the United States. Every year that Congress passes a budget, it assumes certain obligations for veterans, for Social Security, and so on. I actually think we've got a lot of work to do on the budget and try to lower the spending in some areas, increase revenues, and bring down the debt. That's a very important goal I've had. I've always been a pay-as-you-go kind of Democrat. But that's not what this is really about. This is the debt ceiling. If we raise it, it's not about authorizing new spending. When we do that, if we do that, it's in the budget. This is about the ability of our government to meet the obligations it's already incurred. So if there's promises to folks on Social Security or veterans for their veteran benefits and health care, if we have to pay government workers to keep the parks open, then the debt ceiling has to accommodate those. It has to be raised in order to meet those obligations. And what we're talking about right now is a group in the House in particular using the leverage that's unique in this country with the debt ceiling requirement to try to get their way on a lot of other things that would, I think, be very harmful to the economy, particularly if we default on our debt. If we default on our debt, that came within an eyelash of doing it in 2011. We ended up losing our AAA credit rating, and that meant that the borrowing that we had to pay for was much more expensive. So if we actually default on our debt, we don't pay our bills, it's similar to what happens if you don't pay your mortgage. You're going to lose the house. And in our case, where it's the whole country, we're going to lose millions of jobs, and we're going to lose a credit rating, and it's going to wreak havoc in the financial markets that'll have a really devastating impact on Main Street. So I think this tactic of defaulting on our debt as a threat to get your way on other things is extremely dangerous for everybody. You know, everybody's going to suffer if, in fact, Kevin McCarthy and his colleagues go through with this threat to default on our debt.
When Donald Trump was president, my understanding is that the debt ceiling was raised three times during the 4 years that he was president. And I can scarcely remember any conversation or discussion around whether or not to do that at all. It was just simply, well, of course we're going to raise the debt ceiling. Why is it that this time around that's become so much more volatile an issue?
That's a good point. You know, the debt ceiling, it is not about authorizing new spending, okay? It's not about increasing the credit card limit. It's about meeting the obligations you've already incurred, just like a mortgage. You know, the decision that you make when you get a mortgage is that you're going to meet that monthly obligation. And you know what that'll be when you decide to sign that mortgage and borrow that money. And if, as time goes on, you decide that you want to spend on other things in the way you're going to make up for the additional expenses by refusing to pay your mortgage, that's kind of what we're talking about, then that's, as I mentioned, it's going to end badly. And no other government has this because they know that the critical moment when you're making a decision on spending is at that moment you're making the decision on spending, not 2 years later when the amount of debt goes, when the debt ceiling goes up. So what's happened, there's a fair amount of hypocrisy here, obviously, because Kevin McCarthy was for raising the debt ceiling when Donald Trump was here, and a lot of that debt was incurred as a result of the obligations from the Trump tax cuts, which I was strongly opposed to. But even though I opposed those tax cuts, I wasn't going to default on America's full faith in credit, okay? So the shoe's on the other foot. He's got a restive caucus that basically wants to undo the Inflation Reduction Act. They want to undo much of the COVID relief. They want to undo the infrastructure bill that's been so beneficial to Vermont. And this is a piece of leverage they have in an effort to achieve those goals. But the tool is like the nuclear option in finance. You know, as I say, you default on your mortgage, then your credit rating is demolished. And that's the threat that they're making. And unfortunately, I think they may follow through on it. I think there's a chance that they actually will have us go into default. When that happens, there'll be a violent reaction on Wall Street and in the capital markets. And there'll be then so much havoc in our economy that I think that'll bring folks to their senses. But I hope it's not after a lot of damage has been done.
The idea of controlling a deficit or keeping a deficit under a certain level, I'm sure to most people seems like a very reasonable idea. And my understanding, that's what Speaker McCarthy has been talking about, trying to, you know, cap the deficit at a certain point. I think we're somewhere around $30 trillion at this point.
We should be budgeting in the long haul in a sustainable way. And it's a combination of looking at where you're spending and where your revenues are. Whereas these multinational corporations and the super rich really don't pay, and they are able to do a lot of tax avoidance. And, you know, if you're going to get at the budget, you got to be looking at both sides of the equation, how you're spending money and also how you're raising money. And by the way, what the McCarthy goal was, as stated by his budget group, it was essentially to maintain spending on Medicare, maintain it on Social Security, maintain the military spending, which is close to $1 trillion, but then cut 70% of all other programs.
Well, ancillary point around that is, it sort of doesn't apply to this directly, but I've often wondered, on the Social Security front, which is part of this whole question, I often wondered, what is the rationale for keeping Social Security payments capped at $160,000? For instance, someone who's making more than $160,000 pays the same amount of money, you know, as somebody who's paying, you know, making $160,000. Is there any reason, I mean, first of all, why that number, and then why would it not make sense to have, let's say, someone who's making $1 million pay proportionally, you know, the 6.2% on that as opposed to that lower number? That would go a long way towards solving the deficit in the Social Security fund, would it not?
No, I'm with you. You're exactly right. I mean, you know, there's a cap, and then after that, you can be a billionaire, and you finish paying your Social Security contribution within 3 or 4 days of working. Is that right? And I don't think it is. I think the cap should be raised significantly. And what you're pointing to is the reality that everyday people are paying a lot. And the folks who have been the most, they've really been enriched in the COVID economy and even before, they don't pay a proportionate share. And one of the things that I'm worried about in our economy, actually, Andrew, is that we actually have a very productive economy. We have a gross domestic product that's the highest in the world. It's like the per capita income is in the range of $60,000. But that's a function of averages. And that a lot of people work full-time and more than that, but they can't pay for childcare. It's not affordable. They can't, and this is happening in Vermont, they can't afford a house. And what's really happening in our economy is that the surplus that's created through investment and workers working hard and doing a good job, more and more of the profit is getting steered to the investor class, the Wall Street class, the financier class, not working people, not middle-income people, not pharmacists, not teachers. And it's really out of balance from where traditionally it's been. We've had an economy where as profits have gone up, wages have gone up. We've had an economy where as profits have gone up, the middle class has expanded. That's really reversed almost since 1980. So we got a growing economy, but more and more of that growth is going to the top 1%. And what that means is that people work hard but still start falling behind. And that's why, you know, so many Vermonters I talk to are worried about whether their kids are going to be better off or worse off. And in fact, that's something they were talking about some years ago. But now more and more Vermonters are coming to the conclusion that won't work. So, you know, I think we've got real challenges about making this economy work for everyone. And I do like that Biden phrase of work, of build from the bottom up in the middle out. And that's a major challenge that we have in this country, to get our economy back to being productive for everybody, not just the owners of the corporations or the investors or the financiers. And God bless them for what they do. But you know what? The benefits of hard work have to be shared and not essentially appropriated by the folks at the top.
So before we leave the debt ceiling question, I just wondered, and this sort of leads into our second point here that I wanted to ask you about. Do you see a middle ground emerging within Congress and the Senate around the debt ceiling, like some kind of compromise where Democrats give a little bit on some of the bits of on the spending side, and Republicans maybe give something on the taxing side, and you wind up with an agreement before the clock strikes midnight sometime in June?
Yeah, and again, it should be in the context of a budget. Every year we have to pass a budget, and Congress has not been doing a good job on that. And there's folks here that want to spend more. There's folks here that want to spend less, and we can have a real discussion and debate about it. But in the legislative process, when you say each side give a little bit, I agree with that. But what I've heard from Kevin McCarthy is that on the revenue side, he's adamantly opposed to doing anything. He doesn't want anything to come on the revenue side. And what that means is that some of the things that are really urgently needed, like childcare, like family leave, things that other countries have and we can afford, they won't get any kind of hearing over there. So those are debates that we should be having. I don't think we should be having those debates with one side saying, if you don't give me what I want, then I'm going to default on our obligations. Because to make that happen is going to do immense collateral damage. And they won't get what they want. You know, the person making that threat or the side making that threat won't ultimately be able to use the debt obligation we have as a hostage to get what they want, but it will do a lot of damage to innocent people and to Main Street businesses. That's my real apprehension.
And one final thought on this. Right at the very beginning of this whole discussion, conversation around the debt ceiling, President Biden said, it was non-negotiable. He wasn't going to negotiate anything about the debt ceiling. I mean, was that a mistake? Should he have said, well, look, you know, we can talk about whatever. And, I mean, I'm not interested in cutting all kinds of programs and caving in. But
what I think he's saying very clearly is something I do agree with. I don't think that we should default on our debt. And I don't think that I should say to Kevin McCarthy, unless you give me what I want on child care, I'm going to default on America's debt. I don't think that's a legitimate tactic for me, because if I do that, I'm threatening the well-being of everyday innocent people, because a default is going to do immense damage. And I think that's what President Biden is meaning by this, and that is we pay our bills. You know what I mean? You owe money, you pay money. You know, like wiggle and waggle and try to get out of it. You pay it, all right? But when it comes to the budget, you do have a give and take in a negotiation. You know, and some people, like the House Republicans, they want to spend more money on the military, more than $1 trillion. I think that's not right, but we'll have to have that debate. So it's that tactic to threaten to default that I think is so dangerous for the well-being of the country. Whether you want to have the government spend less or more, none of us should want the government to default on its debt with all the collateral consequences that come from that, that are so, so bad for everybody.
Well, we'll certainly be interested to see how this whole debate goes forward over the next few weeks. But let's let me pivot right now to something I've been kind of following as closely as I can, and that's the whole question, and I mean it's a large one, and it goes way beyond just Congress, but as you know, Senator, the country's been very polarized around a number of issues over the past 5-6 or so years, and within Congress, and we're seeing this sort of playing out a bit with this whole debt ceiling question. It seems like it's very hard for Congress folks and senators to kind of work together in the style that I think a lot of us remember from 20, 30, 40 years ago. I'm getting into some dangerous numbers here, but there was a time when it was very common for both sides to sit down and work across the aisle. And when you were in Congress, I remember you mentioning often being in the Problem Solvers Caucus, where two sides would come together and come up with a common sense compromise solution to whatever the issue of the day was. I guess I'm just wondering, and particularly as you've now moved across to the other side of Congress into the Senate, how do you see that process working, where are you able to kind of talk to Republican colleagues and have meaningful conversations without political hysterics working into it, or is it as bad as it looks sometimes from the outside?
Both. Sometimes it is as bad as it looks, and I think we're going to see that played out in the whole debate in the House about the debt ceiling and this question of do we default on our debt, and the sides are really lined up. In the Senate, I'm actually feeling much more optimistic about working together with my colleagues here, my Republican colleagues. In fact, I've got a legislation on fentanyl with Senator Scott, Rick Scott from Florida. I've got legislation on this new terrible fentanyl derivative that's used by veterinarians on large animals, trunk. And Senator Cruz and I have legislation on that. I have legislation on invasive species and pests that are really adverse. They're going to kill our ash trees if we don't watch out. That's with Senator Brown from Indiana. So really, I'm off to a fast start in getting a lot of colleagues, Republican colleagues, to work with me on legislation. So I really feel I'm so far in the Senate, there is definitely a spirit of bipartisanship. There's a realization that we're really not going to be able to get things done unless we do it together. In fact, the Senate did a bipartisan infrastructure bill last year that then was accepted by the House. So I'd say two things. One, in the Senate, I have some greater sense of the potential for bipartisan cooperation. And number two, I've always believed from the days I started out in the state Senate in Vermont that the hard things need bipartisan cooperation to get done. So I'll stick to that approach. That's really, I think, been the way we've done it in Vermont.
I'm wondering, do you see a pathway out of the extreme polarization that seems to have to be such a big thing in around the country, and I suppose within Washington D.C. itself? I've thought a lot about where did it all start, where does it all come from, but I guess the real question is how do we kind of break out of that? Is there a sense you're getting that people are either getting kind of tired of the rhetoric and the political performance, or are we just condemned to seeing more of this for a while longer?
Well, number one, I know people are tired of it. We're all sick of it, and we're dismayed by it. Number two, how do we get out of it? This is a tougher question, because it's not just what you're seeing in Washington. What we have here reflects what we have in many communities around the country. And of course, social media has been the new entry into creating a lot of this discord, I think, where that you have this capacity to just spread lies faster than ever. Conspiracy theories can be spread faster than ever. There's an audience for them. And then that got weaponized, I think, with the big lie about who won the presidential election in 2020, having a major news organization, Fox News, knowingly spread misinformation about the outcome of the election and its merits, so much so that they are just now subject to a $767 million penalty for defaming Dominion voting machines. So this is a societal issue that is not resolved just by what's going on in Congress. And I don't have the path forward. None of us do. What I do know is how I can act. And I can try to be fact-based. I can try to be considerate. I can try to be respectful of people with whom I disagree. And I can do my best to focus on the issues and get bipartisan cooperation to take a step forward. And also, you know, I think we're really fortunate in Vermont, where we've got that tradition of town meeting, and we've all been the beneficiaries of getting together and working things out and being in personal contact with people that you disagree with, like a town meeting, but seeing and knowing that even though you disagree, they're good people and care about the well-being of the state or the town just as much as you do. So that kind of Vermont ethic, I think, is really an important contribution we can make by trying to bring more of it to Washington.
In the few minutes or so we have left, I just wanted to kind of maybe follow up a bit on that point ask you, you know, because one of the issues that's been percolating in the background there is a sort of urban-rural divide. Seems like urban and suburban areas have done relatively well in recent years, in the economically speaking. And yet there's a perception anyway that smaller towns, rural parts of the country have struggled and haven't seen the same kind of growth. I guess I just wondered, what is your sense of that? And are you seeing or beginning to see, you know, some of those rural areas become more attractive perhaps for jobs and corporations to relocate to and kind of rebalance that whole equation?
Right. Well, number one, there is a rural-urban divide. I do believe that. And what has happened is that from when jobs started getting outsourced, rural areas that obviously had a very strong agricultural economy, they also had a manufacturing economy. You know, in Springfield, Vermont, in Windsor, Vermont, we had thousands of machine tool jobs alongside a lot of family farms. And a lot of that, we lost those jobs, and that really started to hollow up out the rural economy, not just in Vermont, but all around the country. So I do believe there's a divide. Number two, I think it's very important that we do everything possible to revive rural America. And it's not just for the benefit of rural America. You know, there's wonderful qualities and values in rural America: helping your neighbor, acceptance of people who are different, self-reliance in hard work. So rural America has made huge contributions to kind of the cultural integrity of this country. And that's why I'm so committed to doing everything I can. And I've got a subcommittee chairmanship on the Rural Development in Energy Committee and the Agriculture Committee, and intend to do everything I can to help this effort to revive rural America. And by the way, what's happening with all this conflict with Russia and with China is there's a renewed emphasis on, quote, nearshoring, or bringing those jobs that we exported to China back to America. You know, the CHIPS Act is an example of that. So there is, I think, the renewed political consensus around the importance of trying to build manufacturing in rural America. So yes, that is a big challenge, but I think it's an urgent need that we have that's beneficial if we resolve it or make progress to rural America, but to the entire country.
And it looks like that, I guess, bringing modern standards of broadband coverage to rural areas, and also an important part of that. I know in Vermont we have our communications union districts stepping up to do some of that, to bring broadband service to parts of the state that had not been able to get that.
You know, broadband is a necessity, just like electricity was. You can't. We saw with COVID especially, where you couldn't be at work unless you had broadband, high speed. You couldn't, your kids couldn't do their homework or be in school. You couldn't go to the doctor for a period of time other than by telehealth. And for all of those, you need high speed internet. So I'm really happy about the progress we made on funding for broadband. Now we're doing the hard work of implementation in those community union districts are playing a major role in that. It's very local. But what I really, really am hopeful about, those community union districts, they're totally about the people in the community. It's not like a big, you know, Comcast type of shareholder deal where they are happy to invest in the cities where there's a lot of profit, but they don't want to go to the country or the dirt roads of Vermont because there isn't a lot of profit. The community union district, they want to serve that person on the farm on the end of the dirt road.
And in the 30 seconds or so we have left, I just wanted to quickly ask, since by coincidence, President Biden had an announcement this morning that he was planning to run for a second term in office. Your thoughts on that? I mean, I know there's been a lot of concern expressed that maybe at 80 years old, well, he would be 86 if he finished a second term. That's a little bit too late in the game. Do you think he's ready to go for another 4 years?
Well, he's going. So he's the one who's got to be ready to go, and I think he is. You know, there's a conundrum here, okay? President Biden is the oldest person to be running for president, and he would be, I guess, 86 at the completion of his second term. So age is an issue. But here's the other thing. He's got an incredible record. And he doesn't have any Democratic challenger. And that's not because there's a lack of ambitious Democrats who'd like to be president. It's because it's widely acknowledged that his legislative accomplishments were very, very significant. The CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, the infrastructure bill. And by the way, on the Inflation Reduction Act, which is really our climate bill, already as a result of incentives, the private market is plunging in $160 million in investment by private market. 46 new factories are under construction. Thousands of jobs have already been created. So he's got a record to talk about and a compelling case to be made to run. And he also has to do that as the oldest person ever to be running for president. So there's going to be a significant burden on President Biden to give people confidence that even at his age, he's got that bounce in his step and his energy to continue with those legislative accomplishments. But he certainly has learned the trust of Democrats on the basis of his accomplishments and stewardship.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there, Senator. Boy, we could easily talk for another half an hour on a whole variety of issues, but I want to thank you again for making the time for this conversation. Really appreciate it. Thanks to all of you as well for watching. I hope you found the program interesting, and we'll see you again the next time. Meanwhile, have a great day.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.